Okay, welcome everybody. It's my pleasure to welcome you this afternoon. My name is Sarah Abravaya-Stein, and I am a professor in the History Department and the Marie Sumato Chair in Sephardic Studies, and also have the privilege of being the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Director of the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. And it's really a wonderful pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon. Before I proceed with a proper introduction, I just have three requests. Our room is going to be full. So if you have a bag or a jacket on a chair next to you, if you could free that chair up, we would be grateful. Secondly, I just want to ask you to silence anything that is noisy that you have in your possession, except for your voice box, which you can use during question and answer and discussion. And I also want to announce that we will be having book signing after the talk, and books will be set up outside for sale, and Professor Zipperstein has kindly agreed to sit here in front and engage in some book signing after the event. So please don't rush away, but do join us for supporting our local author. Now, to most of us in this room, it isn't surprising to consider that the 3 days of violence that erupted in the provincial city of Kishinev at the edge of the Russian Empire in April of 1903 marked a pivotal moment in modern Jewish history. This moment has, since its very unfolding, been considered a horrific episode of anti-Jewish violence, with the word Kishinev, not to mention the word pogrom, coming to serve as a kind of metonym for Jewish suffering well before Auschwitz took its place. What is surprising is precisely how the violence of Kishinev, which resulted in 49 Jewish dead and some 600 wounded or raped, how the violence of Kishinev came to be so widely known across the world, the Jewish world, and beyond, and just how deep the roots of this violence were impacted in history, and how widely branching were to be its implications. In Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History, published in 2018 by Liberite Publishing, a division of Norton Publishers, Stephen J. Zipperstein looks first backward in time to understand the violence that racked Kishinev, looking back to the tradition of the blood libel, by which Jews were accused of using Christian blood for ritualistic purposes, accusations of which tended to surface around the time of Easter. And he also looks backward to the social and economic changes upending Russia and also local Bessarabian society in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It was in Bessarabia, this region, that a reactionary intellectual by the name of Pavel Khrushchev came of age as the editor of a local rabble-rousing newspaper, and then quite likely later became the main author of the Protocols of the Elder of Zion, which was published soon after the violence of Kishinev and which continues to this day to shape the texture of anti-Semitic fantasy. So from Kishinev to the Protocols, this is one ripple which spreads outwards from the violence of April of 1903. But as Professor Zipperstein tells us, the violence in Kishinev generated many other sparks, and it is the second ambition of the book that we are here to mark today, to explore this symbolic conflagration. Kishinev had a role in shaping modern journalism and the way the world imagined Russian Jews. It generated popular plays and poetry, most famously Chaim Nachman Bialik's In the City of Killing, a poem obsessed with Jewish suffering that in turn galvanized supporters of the Jewish self-defense movement and Zionism as a whole. Kishinev, Zipperstein's book tells us, even informed how African Americans, along with white Americans, understood and described lynchings and race violence in America, and partly as a result, this event, the violence of Kishinev, had a role in stimulating the formation of the NAACP. The pogrom in Kishinev, in Zipperstein's telling, was important then, not so much for the violence of April 1903, tragic as it was, but because these events provided a metaphor for the 20th century, one that was not simply Jewish or even Russian Jewish, but global in its shaping. And this, I would conjecture, is why Professor Zipperstein believes that Kishinev tilted history, because it was a shared source of inspiration for so many of the competing myths that mattered to the 20th century. It wasn't so much the violence of Kishinev that tilted history, but the way in which these events were interpolated, how they inspired, and how their story was in equal measure heroized, mourned, and falsified over time. This isn't the tilt of a history forever changed by a single event, but the tilt that people undertake when they peer at history, as at windmills, caricaturing enemies and also the past. Today we gather to discuss a work of Jewish history, then, that is also a history of the 20th century. It is also a work of UCLA. Even before I recognize Steve's many accomplishments, let me say that he cut his academic teeth as a doctoral student at this university, and that his first academic position was as a professor in UCLA's own Department of History. Pogrom is also dedicated to his UCLA mentor and teacher, Hans Rogger, a scholar of Russian conservatism and right-wing thought, whose many works included a book that undermined the widely held, and one could almost say the religiously held, belief in the culpability of the Tsarist regime for the pogroms of 1881 to 1882. This work, I should add, Rogger's work, opened up the subject of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish violence to Russian Jewish historians who had eschewed these subjects for decades, following the injunctions of the great historian Salo Baron, who warned against painting an overly lachrymose picture of the Jewish past. Steven Zipperstein is the Daniel E. Koshland Professor in Jewish Culture and History at Stanford University. He has also taught at universities in Russia, Poland, France, and Israel for 6 years at Oxford University. From 1991 to 1997, he was director of the Taub Center for Jewish Studies at Stanford. He is the author and editor of 9 books, including The Jews of Odessa, A Cultural History, from 1986, Elusive Prophet, Ahad Ha'am and the Origins of Zionism, from 1993, Imagining Russian Jewry, 1999, and Rosenfeld's Lives, Fame, Oblivion, and the Furies of Writing. These are multi-award-winning works. His works have been translated into many languages, and Zipperstein's most recent book, which we are here to mark, has been widely reviewed in newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times and the New Yorker, New Statesman, many others, and it has been named one of the best books of the year by several of these outlets, including The Economist, Haaretz, The San Francisco Chronicle, and Mosaic Magazine. Professor Zipperstein has published in many popular journals and in many scholarly journals. He was the editor of Jewish Social Studies for 20 years, edited the book series for Stanford University Press in Jewish History and Culture for some 25. He is series editor of Yale University Press's Black Foundation Jewish Lives volume series that was named in 2015 a best book of the year by the Jewish Book Council, and that recognized the entire series, not just one. He is now working on a biography for that series, a biography of Philip Roth. In addition to these many achievements, and I have left out many more, Steve is also my former teacher, still my teacher, and my friend, who has provided a model of conducting historical research with dignity, clarity, and passion. It is a great pleasure to congratulate him on the book Pogrom, and to welcome him back to UCLA, where he will now be speaking to us about his book, Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History. Thank you, and welcome, Steve.
Sarah, thank you. Thank you very, very much for that fulsome, warm introduction. I fell in love. Right. I've often noticed that actually someone, especially in a Jewish audience, asks you to speak louder before you begin to talk. That may be true in other communities. Some people are standing including my wife. I don't think. Okay. All right. I fell in love with university life only a few dozen yards from this spot. I remember coming here at the age of 19, having fled the term as advisable, the Chicago Yeshiva, largely self-taught, standing at the bottom of the hill leading to Powell Library, and thinking with more than a sense of mere astonishment that this is a place where one could think about anything absolutely freely. Like all love, that love too ended up being challenged at times, but never truly disappointed. And I've remained stalwart in that love, monogamous, if you will, for all of my life. And for that reason, it's especially poignant to come here to this great university at this particular moment in life. I'm going to read just a page or so from the from section toward the beginning of the book to give you just a sense of its rhythm, and then I'll speak about its origins and trajectory for no more than about 30, 35 minutes, and then open up for discussion. Pogrom, Kishnev, and the Tilt of History explores how history is made and remade, what is retained and elided, and why. I examine how one particular moment managed to so chisel itself onto contemporary Jewish history and beyond that it held meaning even for those who never heard of the town, know nothing of its details, and nonetheless draw lessons from it. It was a moment that cast a shadow so deep, wide, and variegated as to leave its imprint on Jews, Jew haters, on wounds licked ever since. Studying Kishinev provides the opportunity to cut across standard barriers separating Russian and Jewish, European, Palestinian Jewish, and American Jewish history, and to wade through the pogrom's residue in many different oddly mismatched corners. Its gruesome stories would frequently outdistance the sufficiently gruesome events themselves. It took weeks for the press to disprove, for example, the widely reported rumor that the bellies of pregnant women had been cut open and stuffed with chicken feathers. From the start of my research for this work, it intrigued me that Kishinev's violence, the worst of it, lasting some 3 to 4 hours in a cluster of intersecting streets, would come to epitomize this community to a far greater extent than any other moment in Russian Jewish life. These alleyways, especially Asia Street, immortalized now in countless newspaper reports, would become the best known of all Russian Jewish locales, its humble dwelling soon the most telling of metaphors for the impoverishment and grim tenuousness of Jewish life under the Tsars. The impact of these impressions, reinforced over the course of the past century on Jewish perceptions of the world, the designs of Gentiles, the exercise of Jewish power, and the immorality of what Benjamin Netanyahu has derisively called turning the other cheek, are among the questions that have kept me fixed on this moment and its resilience. This then is a micro history as well as an international history of an event that was surely vile, but less murderous and less catastrophic than so many others occurring soon afterwards, and yet would overshadow nearly all. Quote, the time and place are the only things I'm certain of. Beyond that is the haze of history and pain. This is how Alexander Hemon begins his novel, The Lazarus Project, built around a bizarre, widely reported 1908 incident in which 19-year-old Lazarus Averbach was shot to death in the home of Chicago's police chief. Why Averbach came to the house, he had never before met the policeman, and whether or not he actually threatened the chief's life, as was reported, remains unclear. But Averbach's behavior was irrevocably linked at the time to his having been a witness to the Kishinev pogrom. Hemon writes, quote, Lazarus came to Chicago as a refugee, a pogrom survivor. He must have seen terrible things. He may have snapped.
He was 14 in 1903 at the time of the pogrom. Did he remember it in Chicago? Was he a survivor who resurrected it in America? Did he have nightmares about it? End quote. My book, too, explores history's nightmares. And much like the Auerbach tale, it's a story of the uneasy interplay of truth and fiction, a fiction so unreservedly believed that it would become more potent than most truths. I revisit it in an effort to sort through it so as to better understand the tragedy itself and what was made of it over the course of more than a century. Whether cited explicitly or not, the Kishinev pogrom continues to provide a well-thumbed, coherent roadmap, one that retains the imprimatur of history. Such accounts are bolstered by the use of evidence recalled endlessly, but such evidence is at best imperfect, and at its worst, not evidence at all. Let me start where this book started, or just before it started. I had not planned to write it. I had signed a contract with a trade publisher to write a cultural history of East European and Russian Jewry from the late 18th century to somewhere near the present. And in order to try to figure out how to do this book, I subdivided it into various sections. And one of the sections, not even the first, was the Kishinev pogrom. I knew something of its impact. I knew its impact as an inspiration for what eventually became the Israeli army, initially the Haganah. I knew little more than that, and I devoted what I thought would be 4 to 5 weeks. The book took longer. 4 to 5 weeks on the pogrom. I've tended to organize my research time in such a way where I allow myself a great deal of expansiveness on a topic or subtopic for X amount of time, and then tell myself if I continue delving into it, I then suffer insomnia. And so it's a way of organizing time. It's utterly neurotic. It's worked. I don't prescribe it to others. I've suggested it to some of my students. I'm not sure that they've accepted it, but it's mine. And it allows you to actually delve deeply at the same time while avoiding writer's block. And it was actually the following moment that essentially persuaded me to shift from that project that I wasn't entirely happy with. I didn't feel that I could actually touch my sources, dig deep in ways that I wanted to in writing a meaningful book on Russian Jewish history. You could press me about the meaning of meaningful later on if you wish. And I came across, while reading widely, this history, a very good monograph by a man named John Keep on the origins of the Russian Social Democratic Party. And he mentions in one sentence that the Second Party Congress, and I'll describe it very briefly in a moment, held in the summer of 1903, the most formative of all really pre-1917 conferences of Russian Marxism, of the party that became Lenin's, that ended up taking over the country with the greatest land span in all of Europe, Imperial Russia, that at this meeting, the Jewish Socialist Labor Bund failed because of its preoccupation with the Kishinev pogrom. And I started thinking, what connection could there be between the activity of the Jewish Socialist Labor Bund and its failure at the Second Party Congress? The Second Party Congress, which really was the First Party Congress, the first one was in Minsk, and basically it were five or six Jews that got together in Minsk and called themselves a Congress, but in order to sound slightly more important, you call yourself a Second Party Congress in 1903. But be that as it may, at the Second Party Congress, Lenin is hoping to basically impose his organizational ideas onto the party. He could only do this if he actually pushes the Jewish Socialist Labor Bund out of the meeting so that he has a sufficient number of votes. And he realizes he has the upper hand because he's hoping to basically pass a resolution that insists that the party in general controls all aspects of the party at the very time that the Jewish Socialist Labor Bund is preoccupied with its own autonomy because it's all the more preoccupied with defending Jews. In other words, what I learned, and I won't go into this in detail now, was that even this event that seemingly had nothing to do, strictly speaking, with Jewish history, although those lines are sometimes ridiculously drawn in the writing of history, even this event was somehow shaped by the Kishinev pogrom, and that I began to look elsewhere, and I found its echo in many, many, many other places. And I decided that this could be a useful way of exploring how Jews and others understood the Russian Jewish past. For Ashkenazic Jews, the place of modern Jewry's great exodus, and a place often profoundly misunderstood. I've given a good number of job talks. I'm at UCLA. I'm giving another job talk. You see the imprint that a place where one worked in one's youth on one's consciousness. I'll try to exercise that for the rest of this talk. And at one, this older woman turned to me, and I could less and less usefully use the term older women as I age, and turned to me and said, "Why should I believe you if everything you tell me contradicts everything my mother told me?" Which is a good question. And one could only answer along the lines of the great Polish poet Miłosz, who said with regard to novelists that once you actually have a novelist in the family is ruined. Historians tell stories that families otherwise don't tell. That's why we're paid, all too meagerly by corporate standards, to do. And we actually dig into those stories that are deemed embarrassing, those aspects of the past that are part of one's treasured memory, but that in the end, once probed, don't make sense. We're the ones who tell family secrets, and we put them in books, and we publish them, and that's much of what I'll be doing today. I'm going to divide this talk into five unequal parts, talking about how Kishinev became Kishinev. I'm going to talk about, I came up with this only while walking through the sculpture garden a few moments ago, and you can tell me afterwards whether this works or not. Proximity, chronology, photography, ideology, and mythology. Okay, and I'll be brief. Proximity. As a historian, you come to be enormously attuned to the role of contingency, a subheading of proximity, a contingency in history. And in the case of the Kishinev pogrom, it was raining up until 5 a.m. on the morning of the second and the worst violent day of the Kishinev pogrom. Had the rain continued up until 9 or 10 in the morning, the pogrom, as it happened, would not have happened. Pogroms, as well as revolutions, only occur in temperate weather, or at least when the weather becomes more temperate. If you look at the temperature chart of the February Revolution of 1917, the weather gets better, actually, and there's an intimate relationship between the one and the other. What I mean by proximity is that Kishinev itself is located at the most poorest, bribable of all borders in the late Imperial Russian Empire. The authorities there are the worst paid, and to be a civil servant in late Imperial Russia, you're typically not well paid, at least at the lower levels. It's an area where bribery is considered to be simply a matter of life. There was almost standard levels of bribery. We know that in order to operate as a prostitute in Kishinev, you paid 1 ruble a week to the police in order to work unencumbered. And so had the same event And I'll explain, tell you a bit more about this in a moment. Had the same event happened 200 or 300 miles to the east and away from the Romanian border, it would not have been known as the Chisinau pogrom. And as it happened, in some ways by sheer coincidence, but partly because this was such a porous place from which to spread information about an empire that tended to protect its information, this was the site of the Zionist movement's correspondence bureau. It was a bureau that was in charge of spreading information about the movement within the empire and outside the empire, an office that had established international connections to newspapers throughout the Western world. And because the border was as porous as it is, because the bureau was in touch with smugglers, because most of the smugglers in this region were Jews, we know that news of the pogrom was then smuggled across the border with alacrity and with telegrams sent to all the major newspapers. And I have copies of many of these telegrams alerting them to the existence of this, the fact that this pogrom happened within moments. So we can talk more about proximity later on. Chronology, this is the first major Jewish catastrophe to occur at the beginning of a 20th century that is believed to be, hoped to be, a century of peace. And it's a pogrom that's unconnected with any other events. The pogroms, a massive wave between 1905 and 1906, occurred during a constitutional crisis that culminates with the Tsar establishing a kind of quasi-legislative body that will be part of the administrative structure of late Imperial Russia. This is an event that stands on its own. It stands on its own. Its news is spread quickly, and because it happens at the beginning, at the cusp of the 20th century, it's deemed all the more shocking. It suggests that perhaps the 20th century won't be quite as peaceful as one hopes. Under the rubric of photography, this is the first Jewish catastrophe that is actually reported with the use of photographs. Now, photography is invented long before, but it's very expensive. And it's expensive for newspapers to actually utilize. And by and large, even at the turn of the 20th century, most newspapers in France, in Germany, in the United States have line drawings, not photography. But this event is brought home in no small measure, both because photography tends to be used. If you look at the Yiddish Daily Forward, at the beginning of 1903, it's no more than a fact sheet of the Socialist Party. It's given life, if you will, ironically enough, by the Chisinau pogrom and by the reportage of the Chisinau pogrom and by the photography that ends up accompanying it. But also, it's an event that's aided, if you will, whose notoriety is aided by photography because of the relatively small number of Jews who were killed. There's 45 who were actually killed in the pogrom, four who die of wounds incurred during the pogrom. And in photographs, you're able to actually spread all of the 45 shrouded before burial, and Jewish burial Jews are obliged to bury quickly. All the 45 are able to be photographed in one photograph. In Odessa on October 1905, 500 to 600 Jews will be slaughtered. You can't photograph 500 to 600 in one photograph. But you could capture this tragedy visually. It's almost typologically similar to the way in which Anne Frank ends up standing as a symbol of the obliteration of 6 million, a number that is really unimaginable. But one could focus in on the tragedy of this young girl, and somehow the tragedy becomes real. To some extent, typologically, that's just what happens with the Chisinau pogrom. And then ideology. It's, first of all, the only significant event in Russian Jewish life that is embraced by all Jewish ideologies across the board. And contrary to what you may be told now about how there's this curious notion that when there's that adage, one Jew, two shuls, And yet, of course, Jews are assumed to have been completely in unison about all important issues, above all Israel. That's absurd. And all one has to do is to look at the history of Russian Jewry to be reminded of it. Russian Jewry is immensely divisive politically, with enormous divisions not only between Zionists and Jewish socialists, but within the Zionist camp, within the socialist camp, and a whole variety of ideologies that aren't avowedly Jewish, but nonetheless are largely filled with Jews. A joke that I particularly like that was widely told at the turn of the 20th century is, what language do you speak at an Esperanto conference? Esperanto, of course, you know the answer. I'll tell you nonetheless. Esperanto, of course, is the attempt to create a universal language so that everyone will get along. And proof is that everyone who speaks English in the United States gets along. And what language you speak at an Esperanto conference? The answer is Yiddish. And so you couldn't figure that out in advance. So in other words, some of the more fervent exercises in assimilation were themselves fueled by deep Jewish passions. This is the one event that's embraced by all. Zionism places it in its pantheon. The Jewish Socialist Bund does the same. The territorialists and others, Israel Zangwill's famous poem, The Melting Pot, is all built around the Kishinev pogrom. But not only is it situated ideologically, but it's sustained by movements. It's sustained by institutions, which is a key to what keeps memory of history alive while so much else disappears. It ends up being built straight into the curriculum of Jewish Palestine, later the State of Israel. I talk about this in my book. It inspires a poem by Chaim Nachman Bialik in the City of Killing that ends up being widely considered, and probably justly, the finest and certainly most influential poem written in a Jewish language since the Middle Ages. It enters into the sinews of Jewish culture in the way that other events simply don't, and especially since the city of Kishinev wasn't known for anything else. Odessa was known for lots of things. Kiev, sites of all sorts of experiences, including tragedies. This is the one event that ends up being attached to this place. And finally, what most of my book is about, mythology. What struck me from the time I first started working on this book is the interplay between the massive amount of documentation. We know more, not just about the streets of this town in the wake of the pogrom, but about the interiors of the houses of the Jews in the wake of this pogrom than we know about any other aspect of Russian Jewish life, imperial life, over the course of 150 years. And what struck me as extraordinary was the interplay between this massive documentation by ethnographers. There were trials of pogromists with transcripts available that lasted from the summer through late December 1903. Chaim Nachman Bialik ends up being hired as a kind of to write down eyewitness accounts by victims, by bystanders, by others. We have massive numbers of newspaper reports in Russian and Western languages. What fascinated me was the interplay between huge amount of documentation and what actually came to be associated in the popular mind and elsewhere with this pogrom, namely basically mythology. There was an inverse relationship between what actually was knowable about this pogrom and what ended up being understood about the pogrom. I wrote this book and finished it before the phenomenon that now is all but pervasive, this phenomenon of fake news. But in the end, this book ended up being about that. What I came to understand is that history, with all of its equivocations, its pockmarks, its contingency, history sounds like Jeb Bush. mythology sounds like the other one. It's coherent. There's a coherence to mythology. It could be captured in how many characters? I've never used it. And it could be captured in precisely in that way. And that's really how the Kishinev pogrom ends up being captured, where almost everything that comes to be known about it actually is either entirely wrong in various hands, or at least largely wrong, and yet it ends up fertilizing the widest range of mythologies. I'll just speak about two, and then I'll talk with you. The first, and the two, though they're vastly different, are in some ways structurally quite similar. The two texts that stumble from the pogrom and end up being hugely influential in very different locales is, one, the first version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, called by a slightly different title at the time it's published in 1903, and the text that inspires the belief that the Tsarist government is responsible for the Kishinev pogrom and for violence on its own streets, which in turn helps inspire relatively unencumbered Jewish immigration to the United States just a year after, in 1902, restrictions against Chinese immigration is reinstated at the very time that the Anti-Alien Act is being wrestled with in England, and both texts are forgeries. Okay, so the protocols. The region that Kishinev is located in, I can only go into this very, very briefly now, and it's the gist of chapter 5 of my book, and I was partly able to write it because of an accidental archival discovery. I was finishing this book, and on my way to Kishinev just to sort of get a clear sense of the city's topography, and I'd heard from a friend of mine who works on the first version of the protocols that there was someone in Brookline who lived down the street from Fenway and who had something. And so I called him and I went to see him. And this man, Misha Zachim, is a former journalist in Kishinev and had been living in Boston since the 90s. His wife, Luda, also a journalist. He had written a work, either an essay or a book, it's not clear, on a psychiatric hospital at the edge of Kishinev, which is what Kishinev is now called. And in it was the nephew of Khrushchev, the first publisher of the first version of the protocols, who, as I'll talk about very briefly in a moment, is almost certainly one of its authors. And his nephew was there at the psychiatric hospital, and then he dies, and what's unclear, and he dies right around the time the Soviet Union is dissolving, and so what belongs to whom? What are belongings? With the dissolution of the Communist Party, you know, it's basically Hefkerveld. And I ran into this legal problem when I sought to use the material that I was, turns out, given by Zachim for my book. Zachim ends up, a Jewish journalist, ends up carrying away the most personal papers of Khrushchev, who at the turn of the century was considered to be one of the most powerful and vile anti-Semites in the world. And it turns out that this archive, that after sitting with Zachim and his wife for a couple hours, they turn to me and say, "Do you want to take it?" What do you say? And it turns out in it were many of Khrushchev's most personal papers. Khrushchev has had a very vivid afterlife. He's widely celebrated in that same region of southern Russia as a champion of anti-capitalism, of anti-modernism, of anti of homophobia, and anti-Semitism. And it turns out, as revealed in a diary that was part of this archive,
that he writes at the age of 16 or 17. He's having sex, which he describes in some detail with a Cossack of the male persuasion. He declares that he wishes he was born a lady, and he's a closeted homosexual. And though considered to be the best placed and most moneyed anti-Semite in late Imperial Russia, he's completely bankrupt. He's continuing to collect the subscription money from a newspaper that he sold. I have bailiff's reports among these papers that are assessing his desk, his bookshelves. He's hoping to sell off his library. It's an example of how what we believe we know in history could so readily be subverted. Moreover, and I talk about this in the book, we knew that his mother died at a very young age. His relationship with his father was rather distant. And it turns out, according to the nephew, who had no reason to lie and who deeply venerated his uncle, that his stepmother is Jewish. And it's one of these stories where, had I written this as a novel and brought it to my editor at Norton, or the fiction editor at Norton, he or she would have said, no, this is not life. This can't happen. On top of it, and I'll just add one more detail, his sister falls in love with a Jew named Borenstein, runs away with him to New York, and in the 30s gives an interview to the Russian American Jewish press where she's wearing a head covering as an observant Jewess, and she's been living in Baltimore the entire time. What do you do with stuff like this? You put it in a book and then you let people like yourselves figure out what to do with it. But it turns out, and there's considerable, the linguistic fingerprints of the first version, the most obscure version that's published in serial form in a newspaper. The newspaper's only sold by subscription. Many of the first histories of the protocols didn't even know the first version. It turns out there are linguistic fingerprints whereby the terms that are used, the term for goy, for example, which is pretty prevalent in the protocols, is different in the Ukrainian Russian or the Ukrainian usage that is prevalent in the Bessarabia region where Kishinev is located than is true elsewhere in Russia. And all of these are excised from the book versions that are published in 1905, 1906. You could pretty much prove that this was written in this region, and inasmuch as it's published by Khrushchevan, who in a foreword and afterword essentially acknowledges that this was shaped by him and a small entourage, pretty much identify him as the author of the protocols. It's a deeply local production, produced in a provincial place, and inspired in no small measure by the capacity of one person in Kishinev, a man named Jacob Bernstein Kogan, who you don't need to know, to have managed. He was the first head of the Zionist bureau in Kishinev to have spread news about the Kishinev pogrom. He's able to spread the news for reasons that are very simple. He's created this connection with a network of newspapers. He has those connections and he knows smugglers. But in their mind, he is the epitome of the elder of the Jews. The man is a lovely, well-intentioned, mid-level Zionist, basically no influence on the movement. Herzl dislikes him, more than moderately overweight, but who manages to stay awake for the second night of the pogrom, raise enough money for the telegrams, pay smugglers, get the news across the border, and in this respect, there actually is a connection between fact and the imaginings of the anti-Semites, even though the connection is rather tenuous. I'll finish up with Pleve, with the news about the Russian government planning the pogrom, and then I'll end. A few weeks after the pogrom in mid-May, a letter surfaces signed by the Minister of Interior, a man named Pleve. Basically, what it says is it's a letter to the Governor General not to actually do much to put down this riot against Jews, and it basically is proof, and it's widely believed as proof It's believed by Teddy Roosevelt that it's proof that the Russian government actually ferments violence that leads to the beating, killing, and raping of Jews on the streets of Russia. This, more than any other document, is what consolidates American immigration policy toward Jews in contrast to American immigration policy toward other people. And much like the protocols, if you will, and press me at this point if this sounds difficult to swallow, it's written with sincerity. It's written with the belief that if actually you were able to tie Pleva down like in the scene of Homeland, much like if you had tied the elder of the Jews down, this is what they would have said. And so in the absence of this literal witness testimony, you have essentially the words. You're giving the words to the elders in the protocols. You're giving words to Plev in the Pleva letter. But you're certain that if the curtain could be pushed, and you could look beyond it, that this is actually what they would say. And so it's an effort to tell the truth in a late imperial Russia where there's much darkness and where you don't believe you could actually get at the truth, but you've actually told the truth with the use of this of these documents. Let me end with this. What I learned and what I finished the book with is not only the impact of the Kishinev pogrom on the formation of Zionism, and especially Zionism's notion of the defenselessness of Jews in exile, though there's massive evidence of Jewish resistance to the pogrom that goes unrecognized. I learned not only about this particular event's impact on immigration policy to the United States, at a time, it's the first event that East European Jews, now a dense entity in the Lower East Side, the first time they flex their political muscles. And they're able to do it for a cause that has nothing to do with politics and left politics. It has to do with relief. And so it's a relatively safe way to flex your muscles. And not only its impact on the consolidation of the anti-Semitic text that has more legs and more resonance to this day than any other, but also, and very briefly, I learned about the connection, as Sarah alluded to before, between this event and African-American history. This was one of my more surprising for me, detours, because I knew little about the newspapers, the independent African newspapers, independent from the moderating voice of Booker T. Washington, run mostly by one individual, one man, perhaps together with his wife, who questioned established orthodoxies in the turn of the 20th century, and especially pushed discussion about the prevalence of lynching. The American Socialist Party had little to do with African Americans because of the potential competition of blacks in employment. Lynchings were often blamed on the behavior of African Americans themselves, on sexual rapacity, on economic activity, on being too close to party bosses. But typologically, the way lynching was talked about in those circles is almost identical to the way pogroms were talked about in Russia. Blamed on Jews because of their economic activity, blamed on Jews because of their political radicalism. And it turns out that a couple, and especially in particular a woman who ended up just being completely erased from history, I'm happy to say a graduate of Stanford, a former lover of Jack London's, a woman who had actually co-written a book with Jack London about the nature of love, Anna Strunsky, travels to Russia between 1906 and 1908, comes back to the States in 1908 to promote her husband's book, the book of William English Walling, who becomes the first chair of what eventually is known as the NAACP. And she, on the stage of Cooper Union, pushing for this book, says, without actually planning to say it, she draws what we would today call an intersectional argument about the incredible similarity between pogroms, which are getting enormous attention in America,
and lynching, which is getting almost no attention in mainstream America. And it's Anna Strunsky's comment that that night inspires the first of a whole series of late night meetings that culminates with the creation of the NAACP. So in the end, this event, which really at its most ferocious, at its height, lasted no more than about 4 hours on six or seven intersecting streets, really alleyways, leaves this promiscuous impact on history well beyond the Jewish domain, and this is why I stuck with it for as long as I did. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I have promised to help Steve field questions, and I may take advantage of my position at the podium to ask a first. In preparing, not only did I reread your book, but I began to read the writing about your book, and I noticed something striking. And that is to say that some of its greatest fans also seem to have misunderstood something at the core.
Including Philip Roth.
Who blurbed the book. And including Anthony Julius, who offered a very heartfelt review and encouraging review in the New York Times, who seemed to revert back to inherited myths about Kishinev, to understand your book not to be about the unpacking of mythology about Kishinev, but instead an almost reassertion of its historical import. So reflecting on this, I wonder how this makes you feel about the historian's mission. And it brings us back to the woman who said to you, why should I believe you when you're saying something different than my mother? What does it say about this project, but really ultimately about the historian's task of unraveling misunderstandings about the past?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, one, let's say, would be churlish to be upset that Philip Roth of the New York Times likes your book. So I'm not that kind of guy. And there you probably could find some in academia. But it is a reminder of how these are, in many ways, the formative beliefs of modern Jewish life. And very difficult to dislodge. And as an historian, we're not historical missionaries. We don't need to persuade people. We try to do as well as we could do on the page, and then move to produce other pages. And so in some way, when I read the review in the New York Times, and I was pleased that it was there, obviously, and Anthony Julius, who, a very, very prominent attorney, wrote an important book on T.S. Eliot, and he was, of course, the person who was at the epicenter of that whole Holocaust denial court case involving Deborah Lipstadt in London. I was very pleased he liked the book. Was I displeased that he liked the book for the wrong reasons, is your question. It brought home really why it seemed important to write the book, I suppose. And, you know, there are all sorts of aimless letters to the editor as a result of reviews in the New York Times, but I've never seen one written by the author of a book praised in the Times who says, no, I'm sorry, you praised it for the wrong reasons. And so that sort of letter I don't think I've ever seen. And but it's these are our formative myths. And I say our, one writes history, one doesn't write history as a member of a particular tribe. And I don't. At the same time, what keeps me going, and I suspect many other historians of ethnic communities, is a preoccupation with their community. It's not at the foreground of your work, but it's one of the engines that keep you going. And in order to write something credible, you have to keep going for a long, long time, and to be reminded of some of the toxins that inform your people is ought not to surprise. That's how I would answer that.
Thank you. So I'm happy to field questions. Daniel.
Thank you very much. I'd be curious if you could say something about the circumstances leading to the composition of the forged document alleging the Tsar's responsibility for Kishinev. You talked a lot about its impact and not about the circumstances of the situation. And just also, if you're able to, I'd love to hear something about the steps that led to the elision of the Jewish resistance in Kishinev. In other words, how did we get from Kishinev, the actual event, to the Kishinev of the Alex city of Kishinev?
Yeah. Let me take the second question first. The second question had to do with how did one get the Bialik poem in the city of Killing Beer, Harega, is at the very epicenter of the poem, is a laceration of the cowardly behavior of Jewish males. And that's the aspect of the poem that gives it its power. But then I also mentioned that Bialik, who spent 5 weeks in Kishinev, knew a great deal about resistance. So it turns out, and again for reasons that we can't explain, Bialik engages in probably about 80 interviews, extraordinary interviews, with a full range of Jews during his 5 weeks stay. I mean, a 5 week stay that nearly changes his life. He's married, but he falls in love with a painter older than him who has children. She leaves her husband for Bialik. She decides to go to Palestine. He agrees to leave Russia, move to Palestine, and teach at a school established for Kishinev orphans. He doesn't do that. He doesn't follow her to Palestine. But it's a 5 weeks that truly changes his life, and it's in the wake of his writing of Beer Harega that he really becomes the poet that he becomes, Jewry's Pushkin. He, for reasons that he never explains, he locks his notes. His interviews are locked away, and they're locked away in an archive in Beit Bialik in Tel Aviv, and only released in the late 80s, 90s. And the interviews themselves are in Yiddish. The document that's published is in Hebrew. And to get access in Beit Bialik to the actual documents in Yiddish is really akin, this isn't being taped, is it? Is really akin to have to researching in communist Romania. The negotiations I had to go through were just endless in order to actually see the originals, because all that's published is the Hebrew translation. And why he does that, we don't know. His assistant, who actually does the translation from the Yiddish into Hebrew, he publishes an article years later in Haaretz, and he says he doesn't know why Bialik never releases it. But to further complicate this, and a figure who I discuss in the book and I didn't have time to talk about now, part of the story I tell involves a man named Michael Davitt, who at the time was a well-known Irish radical, the sort of second to Parnell in the hierarchy of Irish radicalism. He supports himself mostly as a journalist, and he's sent by the Hearst Press. And the Hearst Press focuses a great deal of attention on the Kishinev pogrom. Hearst himself is courting New York Jews. See if this resembles anyone. He's massively rich. He's inherited his wealth. He's already in Congress. He's hungry. He's hoping to run for president. And he's hoping to galvanize any voters possible, including the dense Jewish voters in New York. And sends Michael Davitt to Kishinev, who ends up writing what ends up being the first best-selling book in a Western language about the fate of Russian Jews. Michael Davitt's biographers mention that he was a copious note taker, and I tracked his notes down, the notes he took in Kishinev. I'll bring this back to Bialik in a moment, to Trinity College, Dublin. And There, too, I was told, the notes were there, the archivist told me, but I couldn't see them because the paper was too delicate. So a tip to any graduate students happened to be in the room, what can work, and which I've seen work in Russia, is you're told that you can't see stuff. But then you go to the archive and you ask for other stuff. And you sit there for 2 or 3 days, and the archivist sees that you know how to handle stuff. And that worked, and eventually after the second or third day, the archivist said, yes, you could see the David notes. I mention the David's notes now for the following reason. David, who is obviously completely outside of the Zionist arsenal, not influenced by any of the influences of Bialik, never meets Bialik when the two are in Kishinev, though their stays overlap. David, in his notes, not in his book, says the same thing about cowardly Jewish males hiding behind stoves while their sisters, their wives, their mothers are raped, as does Bialik. So what I've concluded is, if you will, gamze v'gamze, that of course there was resistance, and we have ample evidence of resistance. And there was ample evidence of cowardice. And in a town where there was no Jewish social slavery board, there were barely any factories in Kishinev, the pogrom was a surprise. There's organized Jewish resistance, much more organized as opposed to the concerted but sporadic resistance in Kishinev in 1903. And my sense is that the behavior of those Jewish males who shame Bialik is really part and parcel of what it is that a vulnerable ethnic group, those embarrassments that a vulnerable ethnic group doesn't talk about. And David and others chose not to write about it in their prose. Bialik, perhaps in the safety of a poem, and because it was a poem, built so much of his poem around it. So we don't know why Bialik hid the material away. And to get to your first question, we don't know who wrote the Pleva letter. And there are no obvious fingerprints. No one has been able to trace it, but there's a mountain of evidence to prove that that Pleva did not write it.
Ellen, please.
Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi, Ellen. So nice to see you.
Yes. Just a little preface. In my own subject, history of women's rights, I struggle with a conviction. I really like what you said about what historians do and why they disrupt families or movements or whatever. I studied with a conviction about the racism of the women's rights movement. It's not true, it's true, but it's unshakable. I wonder if, so I found your comments about this extremely useful. I guess I'm asking an obvious question, which is the notion of Jewish, especially male, because who cares about women, male passivity. It's older, right? And it actually, and of course I was also interested in its impact on the Holocaust, but as an older trope, a really old trope, that is marshaled. I mean, talk about an impact, its impact on the formation of the State of Israel, the notion of Jewish, European Jewish male passivity. So could you say something about the way that actually precedes Kishinev?
Yeah, of course, the notion of feminized Jewish men is part and parcel of the tropes built around understanding Jews and Jewish males, and not only explicitly anti-Semitic, and not only in anti-Semitic literature, it's something that's really pervasive. And that might have been a factor in the perception of Kishinev Jews. I do just want to move, though, to another aspect of your question. As I understand it, what's among the things that really struck me was that there ends up being, in popular Jewish memory, immeasurably more preoccupation with the wretched behavior of Jewish males than with the tragedies of Jewish women. So we are able to reconstruct at least 40 rapes in Kishinev
and 49 people killed or dying from wounds incurred during the pogrom, but almost certainly there were many more. And quantifying rape is enormously difficult. And for all the obvious reasons, we know of at least a half a dozen incidents of husbands divorcing their wives in the wake of rape, because the women are defiled. Women who are unmarried have an incentive, of course, a disincentive to actually speak about rape, because they won't be deemed as marriageable. Recent evidence in the immeasurably more murderous wave of pogroms that occurs with the disintegration of the Russian Empire and with the in the midst of the anarchy that follows in the wake of the Russian Revolution between 1918 and 1921, there's recent evidence that in that period, possibly as many as 200,000 women, girls and women, were raped. And almost none of it officially documented. And just imagine the way in which that the impact that that had on them and on the generation that they came of age in. And so, yes, there are those tropes. And at the same time, Bialik is an immensely sensitive interviewer and immensely good at drawing people out. And he does draw people out on a whole host of embarrassing topics. What's interesting, consistent with your question, is that behavior of men ends up being canonized in historical memory, with the tragedy and the horrors experienced by women really being sidelined. If that speaks to your question, hopefully it
does.
I kind of knew it wasn't an actual answer to your question, but I thought it was good. Yes.
Thank you.
David. David, good to see you.
Nice to see you. Question about word choice in the title. Why the tilt of history?
Yeah, I didn't.
That's second question. That's
okay.
Little one, for some sort of curious. My main question is my puzzlement over why Kishinev. You just mentioned the massive outbreak of violence in the last months and then the aftermath of the First World War, where there's a scale of destruction that's anywhere from 500 to 5,000 times larger than Kishinev. And, of course, we recall the problem that preceded following the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. So why is this such a book site of memory and what the book is about, this prison, it sounds like? Why Kishinev? Why is that name so resonant when you have an antecedent of enormous significance and a follower of a scale unimaginable? I mean, it remains that much of a puzzle. Is it the newness of the century and the hook that a father in the humanity? Is it the concatenation of ideological forces, set against the prospect of the revolution?
Okay, so I mean, to answer the second question quickly, though, I'll go back to the answer. I think my book answers that question, but let me turn to your first question.
Why tilt? I wanted to indicate that one is talking about history being influenced, but not history being indelibly shaped. And so I wanted to think of a term that actually suggested that. And frankly, I came across the word tilt. I now commute to Stanford from Berkeley, and sometimes because of the nature of the Silicon Valley economy, the commute is all but treacherous. And I was listening to an NPR program, and someone used the word tilt. And I thought, yes,
this actually suggests what I'm trying to show. It's not a simple causal relationship, but it's something, if you will, that inflects history. I was speaking about inflection.
And so to turn to your more substantive question, in other words, does the book achieve what the book seeks to achieve?
You already have, I remember in the first review in 1923 in Bucherveld, a marvelous Yiddish New York review of books published in Poland, there's a review of the first volume of Cherepover's History of the Pogroms of 1918-1921, the second volume doesn't appear. And the very beginning of the review, the reviewer says, what's extraordinary is that this event is already receding into history.
And those tragedies end up being tragedies marked by Landsmannschaften, by locals, and don't imprint themselves on the national consciousness. This one does, it seems to me, because it's embraced by all Jewish ideologies, because it's seen as shocking in a way that pogroms won't be otherwise, because you could just say the word Kishinev and you evoke a whole welter of memories in a way that Kiev and Odessa, even Berdichev, can't. Not least of which, Bialik's poem. I mean, think of another document that has been written about a place that is as powerful, definitive, and basically an explanation not just of the event, but of Jewish behavior writ large, like Bialik's poem. So I'd have a lot more to say about your question, but that's where I would start. A question of
testimony
right.
As source material here. And it kind of went on my public asking about who took the testimony, the timing of the taking of that testimony, the dynamics between taker of testimony and testifier.
This is Bialik's testimony or which
all of them.
Okay.
When you were talking, I thought a lot about Alessandro Fratelli's work on mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Particularly around the massacre in Rome during the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and he actually talks about canonization and the mistakes, and the repeated mistakes, as actually being the most revealing mm-hmm. in testimony of performance, right? And so I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the sources of this testimony, the timing of the sources, and how that kind of canonization process, particularly these errors, the one you mentioned before, the woman's belly,
let me start here. Some of the richest testimony is actually the court testimony. And the court testimony is available after the court proceedings end, but it's printed and it's widely available, disseminated abroad and elsewhere. One of the curious features of the court testimony is that the pogromists themselves blamed the pogrom on the aggression of Jewish males. So the basic line is that this was just a kind of holiday, melee, and the first day. And the first day no one was killed. And then, Jews who are unbelievably aggressive, and they identify an actual event in the so-called wine courtyard next to the New Market in Kishinev, where a bunch of Jews, as many as 250, with clubs and also with guns, attack would-be pogromists, a smaller group of pogromists. The rumor circulates that a local church has been vandalized and that the Jews are simply, and the Jews have killed a priest. That's the rumor that spreads. And so this ends up establishing a trope that continues to dominate the testimony of those charged as pogromists well into the end of the year. And so the interplay between how Jewish memory remembers the shameful inactivity of Jewish males and Russian memory, at least at the time, speaks about the event as really a byproduct of Jewish aggression. Very similar to the way in which African Americans will be blamed for lynching, is really striking. So there's lots of different testimonies. There's Bialik's that ends up being incredibly intimate but locked away. There's the trial testimony. There's all the interviews done by Western journalists afterwards, and by those journalists who actually happen to be in Kishinev. At the time of the pogrom, and there's Michael Davitz, who's a brilliant journalist, who is drawing out people from across the spectrum. Once he comes to Kishinev about 3 weeks after the pogrom, but press me on what more you want to hear.
If I were a woman who
No.
I wonder if you have thoughts about
it's rabbis,
about misremembering and the canonization and the people doing this testimony taking our faith.
Yeah. It's the we have one very detailed testimony by a woman named Rivka Schiff, told to Bialik, a relatively recent immigrant from Romania, nearby Romania, who speaks about her multiple rapes. And many of the other women are anonymous. And hers is the longest testimony, and the most vivid, and a testimony that completely exonerates her husband. She's worried that her husband has acted so vigorously in defending her that once the rapes finish, she's looking for him, fearful that he's been killed by the pogromists. So like so many sources of history, they don't cohere. They're not consistent with the received wisdom about the pogrom afterwards. They're filled with pockmarks.
So I know there are many hands. Let me perhaps, could we collect a few, and then as the spirit
sure, but how
could
Chaim Seidler-Feller be collected?
Chaim.
You're uncollectible, Chaim.
You talk about this as the form it is, and then when you use the word guilt, so you're thinking about the influence, I assume, forward of this event in terms of the religious. I don't know if this is for a historian to reflect on, but the fact is, I'm curious about the reception of your book. I don't always see such large crowds for a scholarly historical lecture, standing alone. And I'm wondering if your lectures are met by such an audience, wherever you go, and how you understand that. And how the people react to what you have to say when they hear the truth of your assessment. Is it what they expected, or is it disappointing?
Right. So I worked hard at writing a book that would hopefully lose none of its nuance, but lose no intelligent reader, that could speak as fluently to you as it could to someone who doesn't know what you know. And what that meant over the course of a long period of time, through many revisions, and long before I gave it to my publisher, who then made revisions, was to cut away much of what really wasn't essential. Lucy Davidovich, who I was friendly with for a while in graduate school, the famous Holocaust historian and essayist, once said to me, she said, you don't need to tell everyone everything that you know. And it's a very useful adage. And I kept that in mind. So I wanted, if you will, every sentence to be sufficiently nuanced so that I was actually telling a credible historical narrative, but at the same time, not to be so packed with detail as to lose people who don't really need to know the detail. And so I have to assume that part of the reason, and I have no idea that every lecture by a Jewish studies professor at UCLA doesn't attract this sort of crowd. I'm surprised by what you have to say. That
I think that part of that ended up being translated into reviews, and because it's been widely reviewed in the general press, and consequently, partly I suspect people come to the book expecting something that I don't give them. I intentionally situated the chapter about violence, and I've never written extensively about violence before. I happened to show the estimable Sarah Stein a draft of some of it a couple of years ago, and her response was, yes, but you don't tell about the violence. And I'd never really written in detail about violence coming of age, as Sarah indicated, under the son of Selah Baron,
who instructed us that the Jewish memory is simply too inundated with talk of violence, and yet there was substantial violence here, and I would have done violence to the topic had I not done it justice. And so I worked for many, many months on almost a moment-by-moment description of what occurs on the streets of Kishinev in April 1903, but I didn't put it at the front of the book. I wanted to frustrate the reader who picked up the book hoping to get a good, miserable Jewish story and situated it rather deeper in the book intentionally. So I'd like to believe that part of the reason for the reaction to the book has to do with it having pulled off that feat of actually speaking to, in a sense, both audiences at one and the same time without losing either. And at the same time, I imagine that there are readers who hope for a different kind of book. And but, you know, hopefully they aren't part of the audience today. You tell me when I should stop.
We will collect perhaps three questions. I know there are many, and then we will give Steve the last word, please.
You spoke about the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and in doing some research, I came across some information which was surprised to me, that the Tsar in the early 1890s had commissioned a study to see whether the protocols of Zion were real. And he found out, and he actually did not pay the people because he found that their findings were bogus and would not allow it to be printed in Russia. And it was ultimately taken out of Russia and printed throughout Europe. I mean, had you come across anything like that?
So wait, I'm going to ask you to hold.
Okay, it's not accurate, but go on.
Okay. Perhaps we'll gather, please. And then.
I just want to say, my grandparents emigrated from Kishinev after the pogrom, actually after the 1905 pogrom, so I have personal. It's always been my family, although my grandmother was alive when I was young, never really talked about it, so I just want to say thank you for illuminating part of my family life.
Thank you.
Please.
I wanted to make a similar comment. I just heard a lecture about Chaim Gorizdat, the Israeli poet. His grandmother was raped, and as a result of that, two generations later, his mother was always depressed. She watched her mother being raped, and then the rabbis decided she cannot stay with her family, she is not allowed to her husband, she ended up killing herself. So the positive note about this, I just read a book by Nadia Murad, who is getting a Nobel Prize this year. She was raped by the ISIS. Nadia Murad, and she's getting Nobel Prize because she became an advocate for women's rights. The Yazidis leaders who had to decide whether after all the raping she's gone through, whether she's allowed to be married, they decided it wasn't no fault, she can get married. So we are going forward.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd be curious, you mentioned that some, apparently there were trials of some of the perpetrators of the pogroms. Talk a little bit, is there much about that in the book? And in other words, how many were tried, how many were convicted, do you think the trials were honest, was the prosecution really a problem, being serious about it, etc.? I'd like to hear a little bit more about that unless it's in the book.
Thank you. And with your indulgence, one more hand, and then we give you the closing word, please.
I'm fascinated by the fact that you have been sentenced to do a biography of the pogrom. I can't think of another Jewish author who is as controversial as Philip Roth, both of that people, Jews and women. And were you chosen to do this because of...
I chose it. I wasn't chosen by anyone else. I chose. I'm the perpetrator.
So you controversial authors, I guess.
Am I impressed with the work of Philip Roth? Is the question. Okay, but I understand the nuances and it's not okay.
We give you the final.
Okay, it's not published in the 1890s. It first appears in serialized form in August, September 1903. Nicholas I is not taken terribly seriously. though there is a copy of the protocol that the family carries with them to to the place where they're eventually murdered. The protocols really, they go through a variety of editions in Russia, beginning in 1905, at least six or seven different editions. And so it's not true that they're not published in Imperial Russia. But the document actually becomes famous from the vantage point of Jews, infamous, only in the wake of the implosion of the Russian Empire and during the Civil War. And part of the power of the protocols is precisely in its failing. It's incredibly repetitive and boring. Consequently, you don't need to read more than one page to get the thrust of it. And so consequently, typically the way in which it's read, it's torn up, and then it's either read by semi-literate soldiers or read to illiterate soldiers, and you get the thrust of it easily. And that's partly, part of the power is that it has the power of talk radio. It's not third-person anti-Semitism. You're actually hearing the voice of the Jewish elder. Should I turn straight to Philip Roth, or your question? Oh yes, the transcript. Yeah. So I ended up dealing only passingly with the transcripts. However, the Russian judicial system isn't what we imagine. There's a Westernized judicial system that's introduced already in the 1860s and 1870s. And so on one level, the trials are real trials. On the other hand, there's a refusal to even think about the way in what actually fanned, what inspired the pogrom. And so consequently, Klushevan, who not only participated in the writing of the first version of the protocols almost certainly, but was actually one of the instigators of the pogrom, he and his entourage, the judges don't permit the attorneys to mention them, and so consequently the trial and their proceedings are skewed. Part of the difficulty with regard to the trials and what precedes the trials and inspires the pogrom is that the pogrom itself, and I couldn't talk about this, is inspired by the accusation of a blood libel. A Christian child, age 15, is killed in a nearby town. There's rumors that he was killed before Passover for Jews to use his blood for ritual purposes. There's an inquest, and the inquest finds that it wasn't a ritual murder. But what does it mean that the inquest finds it wasn't a ritual murder? What the inquest finds is that the blood of the child wasn't drained. Ostensibly, the way in which Jews engage in ritual murder is by draining blood and then using the blood for the baking of Passover matzahs. There's enormous difficulty in disproving something that doesn't exist. And so, consequently, defense attorneys in the pogrom-related trials in Kishinev, actually the trials are held in Odessa, but they're of Kishinev assailants and others, have a really difficult time. Because what they'll argue is that what inspired the pogrom was a bogus charge and the child wasn't drained of blood. But implicit in that is the assumption that if the child was drained of blood, it was a ritual murder. And so you're really damned no matter what.
What were they charged with?
Well,
murder or mayhem?
Yeah, there was only one who was... two who ended up being charged with murder, though 45, and in the end, really 49 Jews, were killed. And they were charged with various battery related charges, typically spending no more than 2 or 3 years in jail. One thing I should mention is that, and this is also one of the pockmarks of history, very often we know that Jews who are attacked by pogromists save themselves by running into the homes of non-Jewish friends. So, and that is by no means atypical. So we see a connection between familiarity and courage on the part of non-Jews, certainly friendship, and we see concomitantly an intimate connection of the sort that Jan Gross speaks about in his great book about killings in Poland during the Second World War, Neighbors, definite evidence of the connection between familiarity and ferocity, special ferocity enacted on people who you know.
And again, for reasons that I, as an historian, can't explain, but I have sufficient evidence. Why write about Philip Roth? What if I do this? God willing, I'll write the book. And God willing, UCLA will invite me back. And can I talk with you about Philip Roth then? Would that be okay? All right. Thank you.
I want to invite you to...